participate in this...
Where you have situations where there's pretty highly charged emotion. You have a little bit different situation than for instance, the peace protest. And the police have been faced with this situation. I remember the discussions of it and the press coverage of it afterwards, that during the peace marches, you always get two or three people that get pretty upset when they see these people go by. And there's a lot of hollering and yelling and passing cars and so forth. But it's not hundreds of people doing this, but just a few. And the officers have, in fact, protected the group that was protesting, and which had, incidentally, made prior arrangements to have the demonstration. But in other situations where there, everyone involved is going to have a pretty high emotional charge about what's being dealt with, you have a more difficult police problem. For instance, when Exodus, the film Exodus, first came to town, there were a group of people who were picketing the theater, who did not agree with the sentiments expressed in the film. And during the first showing, I think it was opening night, there was quite a high percentage of Jewish people attending the theater. And an anti-Jewish group was picketing the front of the theater. There was an incident developed. In this case, it was something that just couldn't have been foreseen. The picketing started very shortly before the film started. There was no advance notice of it. And this is a situation where the officer a half a block away is, all of a sudden, it's right there. You haven't had 2 days to know how many people and get ready to prepare for it. And it ended up with one of the picketers got their signs wrapped around their head by someone who got pretty upset with what he was saying. And of course, with this situation, right away, everyone around there is, their feelings are going to go right up with that. There's just nothing an officer can do except meet the situation as it's presented to him at that time. And just as in the Finer case, it's not something that can be planned like the peace march or let's say some student group, Freedom for Cuba or something else, or a group going through some of the small towns where there might be advance notice. This situation is much easier to deal with than when all of a sudden you've got a problem and tempers are starting to run high and the crowds start to gather. This is, as I say, the film was one example. The Wells incident is another, where the people that are going to gather are going to have pretty strong feelings one way or the other about what is going on right there at the situation. And this is perhaps the most difficult police problem that we have. And depending on how it's handled, there can be a whole raft of constitutional problems involved, or there won't be. In the cases, most of the time in Minneapolis, we've avoided many of these cases. Another example, South Carolina. Down with segregation, I'm proud to be a Negro. Signs like these swayed over the heads of the marchers on the grounds of South Carolina's State House. 187 Negro demonstrators, most of them high school and college students, had gathered on the morning of March 2nd, 1961 at a downtown church in Columbia, South Carolina. At noon, they'd broken into clusters of about 15 apiece and gone through the streets to regroup at the Capitol grounds. Their march began in a park-like area about two city blocks in size, which was open to the general public. Police authorities, alerted to the demonstration, as soon as it began, sent 30 officers to the scene. Onlookers began to gather as the sign-carrying demonstrators marched silently. By the time the march had gone on for more than half an hour, more than 200 persons had gathered and were watching the crowd that was demonstrating. Though the persons watching were also quiet, the Columbia city manager thought he recognized some possible troublemakers among them. Police officials discussed the situation with the city manager. Then they informed the demonstrators that they would be arrested if they did not disperse in 15 minutes. The demonstrators instead began to sing the Star Spangled Banner. They listened to a speech by one of their leaders. They stamped their feet, clapped their hands to the rhythm of the hymn, "I Shall Not Be Moved." At the end of 15 minutes, they were all arrested, and all 187 were charged with breach of the peace and fined in amounts from $5 to $100, and given jail sentences from 5 to 30 days. The South Carolina courts upheld these convictions in the view that they were disturbing the public tranquility by inciting to violence. Appeals in the case reached the Supreme Court 2 years later. The demonstrators maintained that they were simply exercising their constitutional rights to assemble and protest discriminatory state laws which were offensive to them. They said that no disorder was evident in their demonstration or in the crowd, and even if violence had begun, they said that the police force on hand was ample to handle any possible problems. City officials argued in turn that they had tried to take a wise preventive measure. The demonstration, they said, was the sort of thing which might bring a spontaneous combustion in a southern city. They said the time limit they set might have prevented a major catastrophe. Should the Supreme Court have upheld the city officials or wiped out the convictions of the demonstrators?
How about the leaders, the instigators? Couldn't they be charged with inciting a riot?
Why don't we get to this question? I think this is a good additional question to ask. But why don't we start with what about the convictions of all the demonstrators apart from the leaders?
I think
where were they doing their marching? Were they staying in the park boundaries or were they marching out on the street?
No, they gathered in a church, and then they broke up. They didn't march in a group through the streets. They went in small groups to a public park, and then in the public park, they gathered into the group and demonstrated.
They stayed within the park limits.
Yes, they didn't march anywhere else. This was a park near the State House, the Capitol.
I think the Supreme Court would uphold the marchers because, you know, you stated that the city manager thought that he saw somebody in the crowd that would create a riot, and that is not enough proof.
They set aside the convictions, didn't they?
Yeah. The Supreme Court decided in an 8-1 opinion to reverse the conviction of the 187. Their arrest, said the court, had violated their First Amendment right, applied to the states through the 14th, peaceably to assemble and petition the government. The decision the justices suggested might have been different if the demonstrators had stopped traffic or if they had entered the park during hours when it was closed to the public or even marched where no policemen were present. But the conviction, said the majority opinion, were based upon evidence which showed no more than the opinions that they were peaceably expressing were sufficiently opposed to the views of the majority of the community to attract a crowd and necessitate police protection. In that situation, if where you had ample notice in a crowd like that, where 200 or so people might gather to watch another crowd of 200, and two or three people begin to try and disrupt the meeting, what, as police officers stationed, would you do in the light of the
Take out the agitators.
On either side.
Either side. That don't make any difference.
You got
they're agitating, take them out. That's what we do with these juvenile gangs on Hennepin Avenue during the basketball tournaments. You get one kid that's a loudmouth of the bunch, you go grab him.
Yeah. Right. And that...
Don't bother the rest of them.
Right. That brings up
works.
Just the point you raised.
It works.
The... where there are ringleaders who actually start, where you've got two or three people, whether it's in the group of demonstrators or in the group of people watching, who start trouble and who start making noise and inciting, come on, let's get them, and so forth, you can pick those fellows out. Sure would.
How come they only charge you with a misdemeanor and breach of the peace?
How are you going to prove it, Jack? That's the thing.
Well, in this case, the ringleaders did not start trouble. All the city manager said was he thought he recognized some who would.
A riot would have to take place before you could convict them. If it takes place during a riot and people are killed and hurt, I think you'd have a basis for it, but without the overt act, I don't think you've done anything. Lynn, he's an attorney.
Now, this is part of the new criminal code. The differences between unlawful assembly and incitement to riot are pretty close, but there's some important differences.
Well, there doesn't actually have to be a riot or anybody killed.
No, that's right.
To
incite a riot, or I mean, right, or the threat of inciting in a riot, and a man could be charged if...
No, they never charged him with it. They charged him with breach of the peace, a misdemeanor.
Because a policeman's duties are the prevention of crime as well as the stopping a crime after it, or solving a crime after it's been.
You're right.
It's just like a policeman standing on a corner and watching a drunk stagger down the street and fumble with his car keys and let him get into the car and drive the car away. He stops the man, and that's the way he got him for drunk driving. Well, this isn't police work as the way it should be done, because negligence on the part of the police officer. That man could very well get in that car and start it up and kill somebody.
Now, this brings up a very important point, and one of the real problems in police work, where you've got kind of a continuous line of where you first know from your own experience, and that you can spot someone, and you know that if this person continues with that conduct, or this group of people, you know perfectly well what's going to happen. And it's a real tough decision to figure at what point can I come in, and then what can I do? Just in the protest situation, where you've got South Carolina, you had a group of people whom the city manager, and in this case it could have been the police officials, let's say they recognized six guys who were involved in fights every weekend out in a small suburb and belonged to a local group and were pretty hot against the people who were demonstrating. And these guys pile into town and start moving through the crowd, and you recognize them. At what point can you step in? There's no question that under this rule, as it's come out, as soon as you recognize them, you can't pull them out of that crowd. But there is a point before they act, before the riot begins. It's true that in Minnesota, under the criminal code, we've got a crime of incitement to riot. Now, some of the subdivisions deal with harm that actually happens, but some of the others allow you to step in, and a crime will be committed as soon as those ringleaders, or the people who could be ringleaders, start some action. So it's when the first mumbling starts, it's a pretty tough decision. How loud the voices have to get, and how many people start moving.
But I know I go along with Carl saying, because the courts, how are you going to prove it? The courts they don't go along with that, a policeman. They say, well, it's a judgment call, and it's best to put a charge on that you know will carry. Rather than let the guy go put a charge on that note and lose the thing altogether.
And what's important about this is that the reason for the rule, and the reason that the courts have given for the rule, is that if they allow a police officer to step in just when he thinks something is going to happen, then there is no standard of control. There is nothing that can be measured except the police officer's own idea of what's going to happen. And this, of course, is just outside the protected limits.
They don't give us any credit for having any discretion at all.
you can't testify to an assumption.
Probable cause.
Well, you get these guys going to start something, they're going to be swearing.
Probable cause for what?
For profanity.
For inciting a riot.
We have a...
He's up there and he's instigating the riot to start with.
Yeah, but you look like a damn...
Here, why don't we start here and we'll come back over.
You have a legal assembly, and these people are there to discuss a political view of, say, a Norwegian Day or something. And they're there with, in a legal sense, in Minnehaha Park. Now, they got about 1,500 people out there, and all of a sudden 50 Swedes... get inside of this here organization, they start jostling each other, and you can see that fights are beginning to erupt. Would you have the right to disperse the whole crowd in order to protect those who are not engaging in this here jostling?
Yes, this has been upheld. Where you've got, in that kind of a situation, I'd say you would. Now, we're all taking an educated guess on the basis of what the courts have done in the past. But here you've got a situation where you don't have six ringleaders or five ringleaders, all of whom, because of what they say, can put two groups together, where the whole group is moving toward another group. Yes, I think you would have a right to to disperse the entire crowd.
What, 50 Swedes to take on 10 Norsemen, leave alone?
Yeah.
1,500 Norsemen.
You mean you still have a right, although the first 1,500 come there peacefully to listen to these speeches and that, but the 50 Swedes come in to break it up?
Well, the way he was saying is that if those 50 Swedes come in and they're all ready for a fight, he's saying that all 1,500 Norwegians are starting to get excited, and it won't just be 10 or 12 that start on the other side, but the whole crowd might become involved.
The same in respect communists like you were citing in Loring Park and on these people from out of town.
Well, I didn't call them communists.
Well, all right, an organization that has a different political view. Now, these other people who happen to differ with their political view, and they're there, and there's only a couple officers on the scene. Nothing's anticipated. There has no past history of rioting or fights breaking out to any degree where somebody else is going to be endangered. If this thing arises, and they got a few park policemen there, and they sent a couple district squads. Now, naturally, they aren't going to be able to cope with a group of people like that. They would still, the officers would have a right to take over the situation and disperse the crowd. You think that?
Well, I think that if the we don't have a situation where it's just a small percentage of the people who are beginning to start the trouble, where you have the entire crowd is becoming restless, and you figure they're... I'll give an example. In 34, in the famous truck strikes in Minneapolis, you had the Citizens League on one side of the street and the Teamsters on the other. What was it, 544? And you know that every one of those people feels strongly on both sides. And it isn't just 10 people in the Citizens League. You've got the whole crowd are riding Star and Trib trucks down along the market. And when the union guys come out, it's not just 10 or 12, but it's the whole group. And when they come together, you know that every one of them are going to be fighting. Sure, I think that the Constitution would not prevent you from keeping the groups apart. Of course, in that case, the whole police department was powerless to prevent some of the things that happened once it got going. Was there someone over here?
On the appeal, they made the Supreme Court, they made the statement that there were 30 police officers on hand, and they called for them to control the situation. Did the Supreme Court comment on that at all?
But this was raised, and it's pretty obvious that the Supreme Court agreed with the brief as it was presented by the lawyers representing the demonstrators. There was no evidence, and this is the importance of the trial level and what you have on the record. There was no evidence that there was any trouble. And even if these five or six ringleaders, which the city manager thought would start trouble, even if they had started trouble, 30 policemen can pull those five out if the rest of the crowd isn't getting unruly. But if you have a situation where the five have started to move and all of a sudden everybody's reaching for bricks and bats and everything, and this doesn't get put in on the trial level, if it doesn't come in the testimony, you're going to have a court saying, a higher court, just judging on the record. And if the only thing that they see is that there were 30 policemen and that there were five people starting trouble, they're going to say that that the policemen were ample to handle it, and the cases would go the other way. Of course, we don't have a situation where the police departments in Minneapolis are ready to charge 180 people, and we do have this situation in the southern states. Many.
How can they charge as many people? You have to testify in court as what each person did.
This has been a real problem.
We had five questions here. We could only testify to three of them. The other four are
right. This has been a real problem in upholding mass charges.
This is where the big problem comes in. And if some of you fellows watched this sheriff down in Selma, Alabama, you noticed that there was photographers back there taking pictures. And one of the major problems in making massive arrests is what are you going to do with them when you get them in? Who's going to testify as to who did what? This you have to do. You have to say, this man, I saw him do this and thus and so and so. Okay? So the police departments throughout the country have found that the only way you can do it is to photograph what's going on. Regular running newsreel on or film on what's transpiring. This is all photographed, incidentally, the HUAC meeting. Everything was set for any incident that occurred from time to time. All of this was photographed, and the whole thing was all set in case of a major dispute between people who weren't sympathetic to the picket's cause. They'd have appeared there, and we'd had 50 versus 50 or 100 versus 100. What are you going to do? We had police officers down there, but when you get about 8 or 10 fights brewing and two police officers to each group of 10, what are you going to do? How are you going to testify as to who did what to who? That's a real problem.
I had occasion to talk to a fellow with the Associated Press one day, and he was saying, and I was questioning how they got these pictures where they, when there's these race riots, and there's three policemen with one poor devil on the ground, they're dragging them, and they all got their clubs. Well, our paper is not prone to overlook these situations. They put it right on the front page. This is almost inciting the public against the police departments or policemen as a general picture. And he said it isn't really a true picture. He said it is a true picture in a way. It's an actual photograph, but he says, and when these riots start and a squad car pulls up with two patrolmen, these press photographers are on the radio at the same time, and they get there sometimes before the policemen, and they stand. Now the squad car pulls up, and the two officers get out of the car, two or three, sometimes it's three, and there's always one ringleader of this mob, like in a colored situation, there's always one ringleader that will show his braveness and charge these policemen. And these three policemen contact him initially, but about 15 seconds after they do this photograph is taken by these photographers, the situation is completely reversed. Maybe there's 500 colored fellows around these three patrolmen, they're right in the middle. But this is the pictures you don't see in your paper. And he says, it's a true picture, but it's a split second timing.
You're taking the wrong picture.
And he says, well, they won't publish these other pictures where these policemen are completely outnumbered. And he says, he felt sorry for the policemen in the north because they were really being discriminated against, because he says, the people in the north are being incited against their police officers by these continuous pictures put in the paper of three policemen manhandling one colored
man. Did you ask them why this is happening?
I think if we all live in Minneapolis, we know.
Okay. Why don't we move on? This is a case that. Why don't we take a real shot? Good enough.
How's your feelings on our?
In this series of sessions, but I wonder if you know what actually happened in the map case. What did? Did Professor Anker or anyone else talk about the facts of the map case? Who Miss Map was and what actually happened?
No, go ahead with that.
Okay. This is another problem type situation. On May 1957, three Cleveland police officers arrived at the home of Miss Dalry Map. They had information that a person wanted for questioning about a recent bombing was lurking there. They also heard that gambling information was hidden in the home. Miss Mapp and her daughter, by a previous marriage, lived on the upper floor of a two-family house. When police knocked on the door, Miss Mapp did not let them in. She called her attorney instead, Shades of the Thompson case. On his advice, she refused to let the policeman in without a search warrant. The officers notified headquarters and maintained a close watch in the house. 3 hours later, at least four additional officers arrived. They knocked, and when Miss Mapp did not answer immediately, they broke in. Miss Mapp demanded to see a warrant. A policeman produced a piece of paper, and Miss Mapp snatched it from him. The police struggled with her until they got the paper back. Much doubt was raised afterwards as to whether the paper was a proper search warrant. It was never produced in court. In handcuffs, Miss Mapp was forcibly taken upstairs. The policeman searched a dresser, a chest of drawers, a closet, and some suitcases in the bedroom. Not satisfied with this, the police then continued their search through other parts of the house and finally discovered a trunk containing obscene pictures and books in the basement. Miss Mapp claimed, however, that these belonged to a previous tenant. Convicted for possessing obscene materials, Miss Mapp was sentenced from 1 to 7 years in prison. Now, how's that for pornography law? Her case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court under the 14th Amendment, which guarantees due process to all persons. It was contended that due process of the 14th was violated. As we have seen, it was never established in Miss Mapp's case that a proper warrant existed.
What was the warrant for, Lynn, by the way?
Search.
Search for what, though?
Well, that's the point. It was never established that there was a warrant, and if so, what it specified. What the police were looking for was illegal gambling equipment being stored there, and well, that's it. The search warrant would have looked just for gambling information. They also wanted to question about a recent bombing. So all of you know what the result in the Mapp case was. But the court's decision stands as a landmark for two reasons. It reversed an earlier decision that state courts could constitutionally use evidence seized in violation of the Fourth Amendment. The earlier decision was made even though federal courts were not permitted to use such evidence. The Mapp decision had a broad impact. At the time of the decision in 1961, evidence seized without regard to the Fourth Amendment was prohibited in courts of 24 states. And all of you are aware of the changes. Now, I bring this case up not to discuss the rules involved in Mapp, because this has been covered very well. But the Mapp case is an example of a recent trend of the Supreme Court to extend to the states protections guaranteed through the 14th Amendment, protections which have been federal standards. In the last 4 years, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court has applied to the states rules which formerly applied only to the federal government in more cases than they have ever during their history of the Supreme Court. So it's not just a Fourth Amendment problem, it's not just an exclusionary rule problem, but the court has, in cases involving habeas corpus, in all the other rights, has been moving more and more to saying to local and state governments that they must adhere to the standards which formerly were only federal. So this certainly is true in confessions. And I'll deal with this one case, and then we'll discuss confessions in a little different way, I think, than you've discussed it before, as to what the existing rules are. We'll take a look at what might happen and what direction we're moving. Wilbert Rydoo brought the Supreme Court the issue of trial by television. He faced the death penalty. The charges against him, a murder which followed a bank robbery and kidnapping, were grave. Yet he said television had spoiled the usual calm temper of justice in his case. Rydoo was accused of looting a bank in Lake Charles, Louisiana, $14,000. He had held the bank manager and two women tellers at gunpoint while they stuffed money into a bag. Then he forced the three to go with him in a car owned by Mrs. Julia Ferguson, one of the tellers. After escaping the scene it was charged, he shot all three. Mrs. Ferguson died of her wounds. A few hours later, Rydoo was captured. On the next morning, newsmen from the Lake Charles television station came to the jail. Their cameras and sound equipment recorded a talk between the sheriff and Rydoo. The movie included Rideau's admission that he had committed the robbery, kidnapping, and murder. Television audiences saw the film later in the day and again on the next 2 days. By the end of that time, station officials estimated the confession had been seen and heard by 106,000 of the 150,000 people in the area. When the case came to court 2 weeks later, Rydoo's lawyers charged that the televised confession made it impossible for their client to get a fair trial. They asked for a change of venue, which is, I'm sure all of you know, just a trial in another location by the same court. Their request was denied. The trial went on. He was convicted on the evidence that he had signed a written confession he had signed. The television film was not shown in the courtroom. Appealing to higher states courts, Rydoo's lawyer said that the television showings had upset the due process clause of the 14th. They pointed out that at least three of the 12 jurors in the original trial had admitted seeing the televised confession, but none of the jurors, the lawyers for the state argued, felt that the television film had affected their decision in any way. The trial, they said, could not have been fairer in any other place. These were the arguments which reached the Supreme Court. Should he have been granted a new trial, or should the court have permitted the death penalty to be carried out?
New trial in a new area.
Go ahead.
On the basis that was one of the biggest deals in that Kennedy situation, that they said over the television that there was millions and millions of people that saw the actual crime. And if they see the actual confession, I don't know what the distinction there would be.
There is an important distinction here.
If a man readily admits doing something, it's the same as performing the act.
I'm going to talk about this because we've got, I think you might see that there are a number of rights involved in a situation like this. The information, let's work backwards. All the public knows about it because they saw the television or they read the newspapers. Now, what's involved backwards? How did the papers get the information? The police officials allowed the television to come into the station and record the investigatory process and the taking of the confession. In other similar cases, the information is released to the newspapers. Then you've got the problem of newspapers and news media have this material available, and they publish it. So we've got a series of questions we can talk about. What are the rights and responsibilities of the newspaper? What are the rights and responsibilities of the police officials? And what are the rights of the person who's subjected to this kind of situation? In this case, as you correctly guessed, the conviction was set aside by a 7-2 decision. The decision, however, left the way clear for him to be tried on the same charges again, but in a community which had not been blanketed by his televised confession. For anyone who has ever watched television, the court's majority opinion said, the conclusion cannot be avoided that this spectacle to the tens of thousands of people who saw and heard it, in a very real sense, was Rideau's trial, at which he pleaded guilty to murder. Due process of law was violated, said the opinion, when the trial was not moved from a community which had been exposed repeatedly and in depth to the spectacle of Rideau personally confessing in detail to the crimes with which he was later to be charged. After the television report, the court said, the trial could be nothing more than a hollow formality. Now, we have a... Go ahead.
They don't say what these two voted for it.
Let's see, yes. The dissenters agreed with the majority that televising an accused person's confession was a bad idea. Their minority opinion said, however, that there was no proof that the television showing had fatally infected the trial. And I think what they went on was the fact that the jurors said that they could have decided it fairly anyway. They said that a court cannot be a laboratory completely sterilized and freed from any external factors. Few people, they pointed out, can escape the vast reach of modern communications. What is important to a fair trial, they said, is that newspapers and television do not cause jurors to make up their minds on a case before they hear all the facts. The dissent also emphasized an important difference of opinion about due process as it applies to the states and the federal government. If a federal official had helped to arrange a TV confession by a prisoner before trial, the two justices said then they would have agreed to reverse the conviction. But they felt that the Supreme Court had no such broad power to regulate methods of arrest and trial used by state and local officials. Now, this is precisely what has been happening in these many cases. The Supreme Court has, and for all purposes we can guess they will continue, to apply the federal principles and the federal rules to state and local officials, just like Mapp, like Gideon, Escobedo is another recent example which we'll talk about. But to spend just a couple of minutes dealing with the problems involved in this case, to come back to the newspapers, the police officials, and the person. There's a real problem in administration of justice where a case is going to be well known. Where I am convinced, and I think there are a lot of law professors will agree, that it's going to be impossible to have a trial with a fair trial in the sense that most trials go on where there's been wide publicity. There's no way to get around it. I think we've seen it in the Sacklin-Vanzetti case years ago. We've seen it in the The Thompson case here is an example. Where can you change venue to that every single person hasn't read the newspaper articles in the metropolitan newspapers? That's true. There just is no place in the state of Minnesota they could go. So they did the next best thing. They went as far away as they could to try and minimize the effects. But there's no question that these effects were there in Duluth. So where you have this kind of situation, the court is going to accept facts the way they are. And for instance, the Shepherd murder. This is where you have national publicity. There's no place in the country, if it was a federal crime, that that person could be tried without some effects of that coming through. With Oswald, this was certainly true. Of course, in that case, where you have the entire country witnessing the actual crime, you're not going to. It's a different problem than the news media and the public officials releasing the information. So here we have a problem, and it's a real constitutional one. The police officials and the newspapers, news media, are set in a position kind of adversary to each other on how should news be handled about criminal matters. Now the newspapers will say, we have a right, we're protected by the First Amendment, freedom of speech. This is true. The accused has a right also to a fair trial, and that's going to be balanced against it. So you've got some people saying the newspaper should use self-restraint and publishing news where they know that a trial is going to be coming up. And other people will say that police officials should not release information prior to a trial.
If you do, the big trouble that we have is you start trying these doggone cases in the front page of the newspaper. And the defendant, it's pretty darn hard for him to get a real fair and impartial trial, really, like you pointed out.
And we had one that happened right in our district court. Judge Brand had was it robbery or burglary? And the Tribune published a pretty large story of his prior convictions. Now, it would have been inadmissible evidence in the trial to bring up this prior record unless the person's going to take the stand and can be impeached with it. But in this case, the Tribune, there was evidence introduced which showed the court that the newspaper article was received by a large number of people, and he did, rather than change venue, I think all he did was postpone it for a time to let the effect of the newspapers wear off, which is another technique of avoiding this problem.
The power of the press, though, they can bomb the hell out of you on the headline one day. All they have to do the next day is print a retraction on the 32nd page in small print.
That's right.
That they retract what they said.
It hurts, don't it? And this is true of everybody.
I read that headline, right. We aren't even going to get to that 32nd page. Yeah, but
this is a problem that everyone faces.
Press, this always kills me. They have to do is print a retraction when they're out. If I may
go
just
ahead,
take
Carl.
A minute before we go on. At this time, and I've brought it up to many, many of you officers, maybe every one of you have heard me make the statement before, but it's real important for you fellows who are making an investigation out on the street. When you're making your investigation, the newsies want the information. They want it right there. They're asking you questions about it. But fellas, whether you've got it here, whether you've completed it, writing the thing up, you're the guys that are going to have to come in and testify on this case. And the newspaper gets it, and they'll add the salt and the pepper and the flavoring to the thing to make it real palatable to the public, see? And it may not be, you made a quote, but it may not be at all what you quoted, but they'll attribute what they write as what you said. And when you get into court, fellas, they're going to have that newspaper clipping, and they're going to say, did you say this to the press? And you had a conversation with the press. This is what they'll probably say. Yes, I did. All right, here's the article, and they'll wave this in front of the jury. Now, at which time were you telling the truth, now or then? And if you're lying then, why wouldn't you be lying now, you see? So you're right over the barrel, so it's best to let another party, your supervisory personnel, make the statements for you. Believe me, you don't have to testify to what your boss tells.
The answer to it isn't simple.
No.
It's going to be found by police officials looking at their practices and by newspapers looking at their practices. For instance, the newspapers will cooperate and have cooperated with police officials in a situation where you want to prevent harm, where a crime is going on, in kidnapping situations, in a situation where people are in danger, and they will many times let the news media in. And in that case, they'll exercise restraint and not publish the news because they figure people will be hurt. But then we move a little bit further, and a person is where a constitutional right is going to be violated if the newspaper is published. It becomes a real tough question of how much self-restraint the newspaper should exercise. It is also true that the release of news by police officials have caused problems. In this case, it was flagrant. They just invited them in and say, watch our confession.
This is the main difference between the two. The one that the sheriff staged this thing, the confession, and then the other, it just happened, it was a happenstance, just a pure happenstance that the shooting took place in front of the live television. They weren't there for that purpose. All they wanted to do was get a shot of Oswald as he was coming down, and all of a sudden they've got Ruby in there with a pistol in his hand.
It's a wonder Ruby didn't base his defense claim on the fact that his privacy was invaded there.
Good
point. Another problem with confessions that you looked at, and I think you've, as I said before, I think you've gotten a better idea of what the ground rules are in confessions now than you could have with almost anyone else, with Arnie Anker. But the Escobedo case, which I happen to disagree with his point of view on, he's very critical of this case. And this is one that involved a Mexican who shot someone in Chicago. And let's see how many of the facts I can recall. I didn't bring the case. During the investigation, pardon me?
It's in this issue of Time, I believe.
He'd lie monthly.
Oh, it was in Time magazine, too. It's posted on the bulletin board at headquarters.
Didn't they arrest him and then let him go and found out more information and got his lawyer?
What happened was that there was a general investigation of a number of people. They picked him up, and while they had him, they received information that implicated him more. I think an accomplice confessed or gave further information.
They had him in, and he was released. About four weeks later, he was rearrested on additional information. They had him in overnight or thereabouts. They released him on a writ of habeas corpus, and they couldn't charge him. They released him.
And in the meantime, he talked to his lawyer.
And in the meantime, he talked to his attorney. He had an attorney.
Now, this is the danger situation.
This is where
a lawyer gets in on a case early. This is where the rules in the early stages of a police investigation are going to be especially subject to scrutiny. In the run-of-the-mill, everyday case, the first time that defendant sees his lawyer is when he comes up in municipal court for arraignment, and they say, have you got a lawyer, or do you want to see the public defender? By this time, in most cases, it's all over. If there hasn't been a confession, the investigation has been completed because the charge has been brought. But if a lawyer is in there earlier, it is in this situation that the constitutional rights especially come into play. Now, what happened to Escobedo was this. They picked him up a second time, and they had information that the investigation had narrowed down to him. His lawyer knew about it, and his lawyer came to the police station and said, I want to talk to my client. And he looked through the door, and he saw him being questioned in one of the rooms. The client saw the lawyer, and they wouldn't let him see him. They continued the interrogation afterwards, and that was it. That was the fatal mistake. They got the confession. This is a case where the Illinois Civil Liberties Union appealed to the Supreme Court in an amicus brief, and they argued that the right to counsel should arise in all cases at the time of arrest, and the brief was pushed at this point. Now, Escobedo's lawyer didn't really go into this point at all. There were all kinds of other errors in the trial and other things he was talking about, but the Supreme Court looked at this situation, and this was the one which was really ripe. So they asked the Illinois lawyer, by the way, who's we hope to have come up here and talk. He's I wish there was a way to expose him to some of the men, because he's he knows right to counsel inside and out, like Arnie knows the exclusionary rule. But they asked him to orally argue before the Supreme Court, which occasionally can happen. So through a friend of the court brief, he made the argument, and they didn't buy the argument as it was made. But what the court did hold was that where a police investigation starts to narrow down on a particular individual, at that point, the right to counsel arises. And this is something, wherever you have a wide gap between police practices and a constitutional standard, we've got a real police administrative and society problem. There's no question that all over the country, the actual practices in local and state police departments are nowhere near conforming to this standard. And until they close the gap between this, in changing investigatory practices, there's going to be just a raft of litigation and all kinds of problems. There are some people who feel that we are moving to a time when confessions will not be allowed at all. I don't know if Arnie said this. I know that there are some scholars that say this is going to come eventually. In some countries, this is true. In England, India, for example, and some other, right, in other countries, they don't allow any confessions. The crime always has to be proved up.
But England in itself has self-incrimination. They allow this, don't they?
Pardon me?
In England, they allow the person to testify against himself for self-incrimination.
I don't think they force him to testify against himself.
A confession in and of itself, standing alone, and this is where a lot of the mistakes are made by the detectives. Once you get the confession, not only police officers, but FBI agents and all kinds of other investigating officers, once they get the confession, they close the book and they say, well, we've done our job and that's it. Boom! Out goes the confession and out goes their case. In 95% of the cases that I handled when I was in the Bureau, we take a statement from the man, have a court reporter there, not a court reporter, our steno, police steno, take down everything that transpired within this room, everything that was said by all parties, and we didn't have a big audience in there, anything like that. It was for our protection, for the man's protection, and so forth. But about 95% of the cases where I sat in on the investigation, we never used a confession because I use it as an investigatory tool.
Right.
Technique, you see. And I went about corroborating what he said. I wasn't mad at this guy. He committed a crime. It was my job to investigate the thing. Open-minded, even though it was the most heinous thing, we didn't care. What the heck? We just had a job to do. But we used this for purposes of corroboration. And when we got the corroborating evidence and tied it all together, the circumstantial evidence and all, we had a real solid case. And the only reason that we even looked at the darn confession was if he took the stand in his own behalf and denied the thing, you see. And then we just look at the thing, put the stenographer up on the stand, and she testified from her hand, from her shorthand notes.
Where we have cities where a department has the facilities and the professionalization to be able to prove up cases by extrinsic evidence, that's the real clear message. Don't stop with a confession. That's
never
the sign to go out and prove up your case.
That's right.
And it's
and don't pick the gun.
You're not going to have trials that way either.
That's right.
You get that evidence and you're going to have guilty pleas where otherwise you'd have a fight. Now, we've got a real problem. Now, I'm not talking about just Minneapolis, but in Minnesota. We've got 87 counties, and how many county attorneys have to rely on confessions to get convictions? You just know that where it's a part-time job, where you have a small police force, where you don't have professionalization, where you don't have training, that they're almost forced to use just confessions. So when you have to rely on that, then there's a lot of pressures to really stretch to the limits of the rules to get them. And when you have the constitutional standard developed as it has, they're going to be in real trouble. And perhaps this is the way it'll be solved. When people of a county find case after case after case that's going to start getting thrown out, then the people of the community have to look at what the responsibilities are in giving the police departments and the public officials the resources they need to do the professional job that's necessary. The
I talked to you before on that. The teaching this, just like the juvenile school, like I said, you go out there a whole week and you're constantly from morning to night in the school, you're constantly made aware of how to understand the juvenile. And there's so much stress on the adults understanding the juvenile. Child psychologists pushed this about 10, 12 years ago, and they're pulling their horns in on the jail. And there doesn't seem to be anything to go along rider with it to educate the juvenile into how to understand the adult or to respect the adult. Much the same as now, all the stress is put on, like, make the person aware of his civil rights and not be conscious of his civil responsibilities in the community. And I think that this should be just as important. And as a police officer, this has to be correlated some way, because if you constantly make the man aware of his civil rights, and he just, he isn't really deserving of any, you might say. Maybe he's a detriment to the community. But he's constantly being pounded into the civil rights.
Well, you raised two things, and I reacted to them when we were talking individually. You're kind of raising two problems. The first is a very serious one, the problem of the juvenile and civil liberties. You're right that our juvenile law and our juvenile courts, not just in Minnesota, but all over the country, have changed, and when they were created, reflected the psychologist professions and the psychiatry professions. And the laws were drafted to best make use of these tools in rehabilitation of young people. Now, I don't happen to have any quarrel with this as an end result. But what has happened is that in many areas, and in many respects, our own juvenile court code reflects this. There has been no attention paid to what happened to that juvenile before he was a judge delinquent. The social workers are in on that thing from the beginning, and the lawyers and the police officers are out there doing an entirely different job than they would be doing for and with an adult before that adjudication. That's a real problem when you face the fact that we've got supposedly the law, the reason that we've given up constitutional guarantees for the juvenile. Let's take a look at what they don't have. They don't have a trial by jury by right. They don't have the right to, which is perhaps the most important right, mental commitment. This is the same problem. When you deny some of the basic criminal constitutional guarantees, the right to indictment, information, and so forth, they say, well, you don't get the rights because it's not a crime, it's a social disease. Psychologically, that's sound. We can't quarrel with that. But the effects of being a juvenile delinquent, of an adjudication of delinquency, often have the effect of crime. For instance, all the military services require disclosure of a juvenile record for everyone who enlists. We happen to feel as an organization that this violates the constitutional protections of the juvenile. It's a federal thing, and there's a real problem. It's a violation of our Juvenile Court Act, because the Juvenile Court Act seals those records except by order of the judge. So they get those records, and they say, if you don't give us the records, we won't let you in the service. So what are these records? They treat it exactly the same as a criminal record. Juvenile offenses, if you have more than three, some of the services, like the Navy, automatic disqualification. And they count juvenile records right along with offenses after 18. So if society is going to treat something as a crime afterwards, then the constitutional guarantees should apply to it before. Now this comes to focus locally in the procedures which go on before a juvenile is a judge delinquent. And I think that our recent judges, Tollickson and Arthur, have been really magnificent in developing court rules which take a real look at what happens before the adjudication. And I would say that we're moving toward a time, and should be, that the kind of investigation that should go on a police level should be, to some extent, the same kind of thing that would go on with an adult crime. Because I think that I think that the court should have to be shown that this child committed an act, and this proved up with the same guarantees that an adult would have. So if you pick up a 15-year-old kid in a burglary, they shouldn't have an opportunity to dispose over him unless the facts have been established that he committed that, which if an adult would be burglary. So we've got some of these problems with right to counsel, with the nature of the investigation, with confessions perhaps, which might arise before we get to the point that the judge can say, okay, this is the evidence, these are the witnesses, I can make a finding that this person committed fact A, B, C, and D. And this finding, then he judges him delinquent. That's the time to bring in the curative parts of the law. And this is this is something which isn't really well defined yet. There are a lot of problems that we have in Minnesota and that many states have that are going to have to be worked with. So the police officer is faced with a real problem. And this, in how do you handle juvenile cases before they come up for adjudication and decision? I want to spend a few minutes on some of the problems involving civil rights legislation. Constitutionally, because the Civil Rights Act, starting with the one in 1875 through the one in 64, are laws which have been passed by Congress pursuant to the 14th Amendment. The reason they were passed and given the power to be passed is because equal protection has not been realized by Negroes, and they've sought to implement the Constitution by legislation. Just very briefly, the Civil Rights Act in 1964 provides for discrimination, forbidding discrimination in employment. Public accommodations is affected, schools are affected, voting rights, and so forth. In Minnesota, the 1964 Civil Rights Act is not stronger than the laws that we have had already on the books. In Minnesota, in 1955, there was a Fair Employment Practices Act passed, which guarantees equal employment and equal opportunity in employment. In 1961, there was a Fair Housing Act, which was passed. Now, the Civil Rights Act, the national one, doesn't even deal with housing. The law that we have now in Minnesota applies to the sale and rental of private homes if it's publicly financed. That is, if there's an FHA or other federally assisted VA loan, for instance. It does not now apply to the sale or rental of a family home, of a single family home, if there's private financing or if it's wholly owned. It does apply to apartment houses, rooming houses, and lodging houses. The governor has asked this session and the last session for the Housing Act to be extended to all housing. I'm not sure what the chances are. You can make a political guess as well as I can whether the 65 legislature is going to pass the civil rights program as outlined. It's important to know this because it's very possible that persons who are aggrieved, who are discriminated against, who are not familiar with what our laws are, may call and may ask the assistance of public officials. In some laws, in some states, it's just a simple misdemeanor where there is discrimination laws. And there, if people have faced discrimination in housing or employment, they have called the public officials and made a complaint to either the city attorney or the county attorney. And in this case, we have a situation where I'm sure most of the county attorneys in the 87 counties are not aware, because it has not been raised, of some of the discrimination laws that apply. You may run into a situation of giving advice. And in this case, the laws that I have mentioned are administered by a state agency called the State Commission Against Discrimination. The reason we had have a commission system in the state, the reason behind it, is because this problem is often best solved by conciliation, persuasion, and by education. So there's an investigation. The commission people can work with both the complainant and the person complained against, And by far the greatest majority of complaints are solved without any legal action. There are sanctions available under the present law. They're pretty cumbersome. It takes a long time before it happens. But there is the possibility of court enforcement of the commission's order and the order of the Board of Review. So there is, to some extent, sanctions in the area of housing and employment. The perhaps a more important area for you men to know about is public accommodations. We have a statute in Minnesota which was passed 79 years ago, which now states that no person shall be excluded on account of race, color, national origin, or religion from full and equal enjoyment of any accommodation, advantage, or privilege furnished by public conveyances, theaters, or other public places of amusement, or by hotels, barbershops, saloons, restaurants, or other places of refreshments, entertainment, or accommodations. Every person who violates any provision of this section, or aids or incites another to do so, shall be guilty of a gross misdemeanor, and in addition to the penalty, therefore, shall be liable in a civil action to the person aggrieved for damages not exceeding $500. This statute applies to all hotels, motels, restaurants, nightclubs, and all the other things that are mentioned here. The biggest area of discrimination that has occurred in the metropolitan area over the years has been in the in nightclubs and bars. The hotel discrimination, which we did have to some extent 15 years ago, has been worked out. And this is, Minneapolis, for instance, was the first city in the United States which had a fair FEPC ordinance. And there was a mayor's commission back in those days, and things like Marian Anderson getting turned down at the Nicollet Hotel about 15 years ago. The main big areas of business have been worked out. So the discrimination problem as it has existed in the recent years are in the metropolitan areas, bars and nightclubs, and in the rural areas, in the resorts and motels. I'll take
a question. How would your organization feel if you received a complaint from a colored person that they were denied, in a local hotel, if it could be proven that that person was a known prostitute?
Now, rather than answer it directly, I wanted to deal with this situation because you as detective just very well may be asked to investigate a complaint in preparation to a trial. The first part of the answer is that our organization has not really been directly involved in much of the civil rights legislation. I personally have had experience with it because I was a research and investigator for the St. Paul Fair Employment Practices Commission, and then was assistant director of the Governor's Human Rights Commission, and we did get many complaints that I worked with. To explain a little further before I get to your answering your question. The gross misdemeanor, as you all must know, is administered by the county attorney, and the person has a right to a jury trial, and the county attorney can, if he wishes, call a grand jury or bring in information. It's not something which can be administered simply by the city attorney just saying this statute has been violated, bringing a complaint, getting it into municipal court. It has to come through the county attorney's office. There have been two prosecutions in 80 years. One, I believe, did occur in Minneapolis, and one occurred up in one of the northern counties. The most county attorneys don't know about it. And very often, a complaint will come in rather than the people who come from out of state may not know that it's a gross misdemeanor and that they should go to their county attorney. They'll call a policeman. And we have had instances where a call will come into the complaint desk of a sheriff's office or a local police department with someone saying, I've been turned down in a room. And the officer that goes out on call is one who has the question of what to do. Well, how would you make such an investigation, and what would you look for? And what is discrimination as covered by the statute? There's another statute which just follows this, which would solve a lot of problems for hotels and motels. This statute says that makes it a misdemeanor for a hotel or motel not to have a registration book. And it makes it a misdemeanor for a person not to give the correct name and address when they register. So you've got a two-edged sword, which at least partially guarantees that there are going to be some registrations kept. Of course, where you've got motels with a whole line of Minnesota license plates, I think you might find the standard of practice might be a little different than the statute. But ordinarily, at least you're going to have names and addresses there. So what are the usual means of discrimination? It comes up by a Negro or other family might come into a motel, and the first thing the proprietor is going to say if he's going to discriminate, I'm full. Well, if you can go out and see that there are 10 berths for cars and three cars parked there, this is going to probably tip off the person that he's being discriminated against. So an investigation should include what you would do in any other kind of complaint. You'd talk to the person behind the desk, and the statute does allow a peace officer or police officer to inspect the registration books of hotels and motels. It's not something which you need a search warrant for. It's not something you need any advance authorization. So you can ask to see that registration book. Now, this is something which likely would not come up in the metropolitan area, but it does come up outstate. So by looking at that, you can tell whether there's space. If there is space, and that's the reason he's given, that's just a cold case. And the thing you would do is, if with any other complaint of a gross misdemeanor, you take the information, take your statements, make your investigative report, and inform the complainant that it's the county attorney that he should see about filing a complaint. And in that case, you've got an investigation report, which is going to show him whether a crime has been committed or not. Now, the this is a real equal protection problem. If people are treated differently, it is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It is also the kind of evidence that would sustain a conviction of discrimination. Now, there are going to be very few convictions because a gross misdemeanor is pretty serious. But usually what's going to happen is if you've got a county attorney on their toes, or if you have a police officer at the scene on his toes, that person may not even know the law exists. If he knows that this has happened and that this is going to be a violation of law and what he faces, usually it's settled right there. And county attorneys have, and attorneys representing people have, talked to people, talked to proprietors, and they've changed their practices. Just in other words, the criminal law has been used as an instrument of conciliation and persuasion. So if you've got a person who is in the same shoes as any other person who comes in, and he's charged more money, he's charged $2 for a drink, for instance, instead of 50 cents that everybody else is paying, or he's charged twice as much for a room, or treated in other ways differently than other patrons would be a violation of the act. Now, the question that you pose would be something which would not be a violation. If, for instance, a place does not serve people who are drunk and disorderly, or if a hotel does not, as most hotels will not, let in and give a room to an obviously drunk person, then the fact that a minority group person comes in and falls into that classification would not violate the statute. So a person who, a minority group person who is drunk and dirty and so forth, coming into a hotel and asking for a room, could be denied, just as any other person who is drunk and disorderly and dirty could be denied. The same is true with serving a person food or serving a person liquor. But the real test is this person being treated differently than anyone else would be, either in prices or in treatment? It's a law which may be changed. This is another area that the legislature is being asked to include under the State Commission Against Discrimination, so it won't fall just on the shoulders of the police officers and the county attorneys, but give a commission a chance to work with these problems.
How many of you know what to do as a matter of policy from the department? Would you like to have me take about 2 seconds to give it as a department policy? Here's what you do when you get these problems, fellas. If it's a bona fide case, or if it's a case like you brought up here, Jeff, and it's a prostitute that you recognize, or that the hotel says, well, I've seen her come in here. The man that works here tells me that she's a known hustling broad on the avenue, and she's come here. Comes here, she's been here before with 2-3 other guys, and we just don't want her around here anymore. Get her out, we just won't rent her a room. Then you have a bona fide case, just the same as what Lynn brought up with regards to the drunk. But if it's a real bona fide case where it's a couple, say three people, say three colored people that are sober, go down here to Charlie's. Charlie says, "We're not going to serve you. We don't serve Negroes, and that's it. Get the hell out of here." So they call the police, and they're mad. They want to get served in there. So you're on the squad. You go there. What do you do? First thing you do, you walk in there. Who was the one that refused to serve you? So did you refuse to serve? Do you refuse to serve these people? The guy says, "You're damn right. I don't want them around here." Okay. What's your name? Mark it down. Your name, address, time, hold it. Get the names of the people that are complaining. Hand the bartender or whoever you're talking to, the manager, whoever's in charge of the place, the names of the three people that that you have. Hand the three people the name of the person who has told them that he refuses to serve them. And then tell them, "Now, you may subpoena me in this case. Go up to the county attorney's office, and this is what it is. It's a violation, and it constitutes a gross misdemeanor, and that's as far as you have to go. Now, they are the ones to bring the action up to the county attorney's office, and you are the witness, and you make the notes in your notebook, record them, the date, the time, what happened, the conversations, the names, and the whole thing." And that's the policy of the department.
What about subtle discrimination, which I would think most places would be the bad table by the door, the bad steak, the soup with the thumb in it, or something like that? What would you do in a case like that, which a smart joint would do?
This is a problem, and the law has not been clearly defined. No, none of these cases have gone up there. I know of a case right now that's pending in a court, discrimination on the basis of treatment. On the other hand, I've had a case where the guy put a napkin in the sandwich. Well, that's cold. There's no question about that. But where you get down into these finer shades, sure, they're tough problems. But another thing that's going to prove up a case of discrimination is a pattern of treatment. If this guy has had a series of calls over the past 6 months where he's done the same thing over and over again, this is going to be considered as evidence of discrimination. Now, it may not be enough to get to convict him of a crime, because we've got a different burden of proof here. For the crime, there's going to have to be reasonable doubt. But where we're talking about civil liability, whether it's the state commission investigating a case or whether it's the Negro or other minority person suing that place for $500, which is another part of the statute. There's civil liability here. The burden of proof is only a preponderance of the evidence, like any other civil case. And there it's going to be relevant whether there has been a pattern of the same practice in the past with other people. But if you want to go on, I'd be glad to go on, but I see I don't want to keep you here too late.
How many more years are you going to be before there'd be a switch in that minority group?
Go ahead.
In the same respect, the officer is called at a scene, and he goes in there, wants to talk to the manager, and he says, "I don't have to talk to you." He says, "I got my constitutional rights. I don't have to say a word to you."
That's absolutely right.
Then what?
Well, you're faced with the same problem as any other person who's a potential criminal defendant exercising his rights.
They're in there to buy a drink all day. Just go through the same procedures when they were refused. And if they serve them, you got nothing.
But where you do have the registration in a hotel or motel situation, you've got a statute that makes that a public record. It's not his personal property. But as far as getting a statement from the bartender or the owner, if he wants to talk to his lawyer, you're just in exactly the same situation as any other potential defendant.
I had one case just like that. It was up on Cedar Avenue. Colored gentleman and his lady friend had gone into the bar, and they'd ordered a drink. They got one drink. They went to order a second drink. The bartender informed this fellow, he says, "I think you've had enough. He wouldn't serve him anymore. They called us." We came up there, and we did just like Carl said. We got the bartender's name and these other people's name, and we passed them back and forth. We told this guy to take his case to the county attorney or the NAACP or whoever he liked. And the bartender told us in front of these people that he had served them the one drink, and that in his opinion, this fella had enough to drink and he couldn't serve him anymore because he figured that he had had enough to drink and he wasn't going to serve him anymore.
Well, what's going to tip that is, was he smashed when he came in?
Well, the bartender
that's
said
that
it was his opinion that the guy had been drinking before he even came into the bar.
Well, what was your opinion? Was the guy obviously drunk?
No, he wasn't obviously drunk, but he had had some
that's what's
drink.
Going to be important in deciding that case.
His
just as important, your impressions and your evaluation of the man who's arrested for drunk driving.
Well,
you've got
I
exactly
think
the same
a
situation.
Point there in civil law that this bartender may be justified in refusing a drink if the man was drinking when he came in, or had been drinking,
right,
on the basis of the fact that he got there by an automobile.
Fellows, thanks very much.